Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bradley Morgan, and I am joined today by my guest, Shara Rambaran. Shara is Assistant Professor of Music at Bader International Studies Center in the UK. She also co-runs the Art of Record Production Conferences and is an editor on the Journal on the Art of Record Production and co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of Music and Virtuality. Shara's latest book is Virtual Music, Sound, Music, and Image in the Digital Era, and is published by Bloomsbury Academic. Shara, thank you for joining me today.
Hello, Bradley. Thank you so much for inviting me and for the opportunity to talk about my book.
Of course. I think this is a fantastic book. But for those listening who may not be familiar, please share with us what your book is about.
Sure. So Virtual Music, Sound, Music and Image in the Digital Era was published by Bloomsbury Academic last year in April 2021. And my book, Virtual Music, explores the interactive relationship of sound, music, image, and its uses in the digital era. And the way I apply the term uses is actually quite ambiguous, because in the book, I like to refer to creators such as music composers, and more importantly, the listeners as well, the audience, the consumers, the fans. And while the term virtual music itself can be very ambiguous and complex to define and understand, just like if you're going to have a conversation on what is popular music, or music will be here forever discussing it and having interesting conversations. So the same can be applied to virtual music, because there are so many areas, ideas, features and debates to consider and contemplate. For my book, I have really focused on the fascination and innovations surrounding virtual music by investigating artists and creators such as Grace Jones, The Weeknd, Kraftwerk, Madvillain, Gorillaz and Danger Mouse. And I also look at other forms of virtual music such as audiovisual materials such as video games and soundtracks such as Cuphead and musical styles such as chiptune.
Yeah, it's a really comprehensive book. So we'll start from the beginning. In the introduction to your book, you say that the concept and interplay of virtual and digital are complex, but we generally apply these terms freely without justifying their usage. Can you tell me what is the difference between digital and virtual in the context of your book, and how do these concepts impact music?
Yeah, so we've all been used to using these terms separately, but without us realizing in everyday conversation. And from my approach, virtual or virtuality, you know, is something that you think of, you know, in your mind, or some kind of illusion or imagination. And with digital, it's always some kind of medium or some kind of technology or device that helps to put that illusion into reality, so to speak. And for the sake of that book, because I've been there, we've experienced it, we always, you know, play with the terms virtual and digital. Throughout the book, I kind of use the terms together, digital, virtual, and I thought it'd be a nice unique way of applying the term, and without having to think, oh, am I using this term correctly? Because people are using virtual when they're discussing digital technology anyway. And we are obviously, because of the pandemic, we are so used to using the term virtual, especially now, you know, when we're doing online stuff like the podcast or education, we're so used to using virtual when we are relying on digital technology to make this possible. Yeah.
That's interesting you say that, because one of the earliest chapters, when you frame this idea of digital and virtual, is by exploring the history of technology and delivering music as a medium, you know, from gramophone to vinyl to MP3. So I want to know how access to music as either a creator or listener has evolved and expanded over time with this technology.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Because back in the day, when, you know, early science of music technology, yeah, it all comes down to affordability and accessibility. And, you know, when you mention devices such as gramophone, of course, you know, if for the consumer, you know, it wasn't always that easy to have hands-on unless you can, you know, freely afford it. And over the years and so, you know, music technology has really been designed for music industry use and creativity and composition, or musicians that can have access to it. And, you know, as time or decades have gone by, slowly but surely, certain music technologies and audio devices have become more affordable, even more so today. And in the book, I do emphasize on that, especially with the likes of using computers or laptops. There is so much software out there that's very affordable and hopefully accessible as well, you know, depending where you're located, as long as you've got a decent internet connection as well. I find that really important that everyone has some kind of opportunity and access to music making or listening to music. So I do believe now, you know, there's so much choice out there in terms of having access to technology and affordable choices as well.
And that was a really interesting angle with your book, to talk about the accessibility of music and music technology. And when I think about digital and virtual, I do think of computers and synthesizers and those kind of things within like the last, you know, 20 or 30 years. But there's some examples where you bring in full circle the older forms of music and connecting that narrative of accessibility and even social change. And when you're discussing experimental music, in your book, you say earlier experimental music provided the foundations for future music. And in one of the examples you brought up was krautrock, which is, for our listeners out there, krautrock is a questionable term that British journalists use to market this style of music. It's usually to describe rock or rock-centric music coming from Germany. It's an out-of-date term, but it's there for the, you know, kind of historical context. But you say that this genre was based on postmodernism and surrealism and broke the dominance that the United States and UK had on popular music, while also expressing a creative desire to escape Germany's devastation and think toward a brighter future through musical creativity. Share with us more about the social and musical impact of that in terms of, you know, what experimental music can do, what experimental technology can do to break down those kind of social constructs and increase an accessibility to new thoughts and ideas.
Yeah, so with the style, like you mentioned, for example, you know, it was an expressive way for musicians to express their feelings and their emotions of the after effects, you know, of the war, for example, and to experiment in, you know, with their music, which is why it might, you know, it may not be pleasing to everybody's ear. You know, it might sound very, you know, based on noise or very surreal, like you said. You know, the idea of experimenting with everyday sound and sonics and technologies, you know, the idea of breaking rules and conventions when we apply the term postmodernism, but to maintain, you know, the roots of why they explore and experimented with this music in terms of, you know, the haunting side of the history and putting that into action. And, you know, while it may not be pleasing to everybody's ear, for those who will appreciate it, you know, they will be able to sense and again have that illusion what the musicians and creators are feeling. And, you know, and again, it's almost like an instrumental side of storytelling, right? You know, yeah, just through the music alone, and they could pick up all the effects, the emotions, just by hearing the sounds in the music. Yeah, so that's why, yeah, so I for that chapter alone, yeah, I was very specific in terms of styles and genres. Of all the styles and genres I could have chosen, you know, I wanted to really focus on, you know, electronica, electronic music, and later on hip-hop as well.
So how did artists like Kraftwerk do that with their music?
Oh, just by exploring with instruments, sounds, machines, the obsession with machines as well, you know, and the idea of bringing everyday other technologies into the equation as well, you know, that it, from where they're from in Germany, you know, it's a very industrial, I wanted to hone in on the industrial cities and how they apply that into their music, and which shouts out, you know, where their roots as well, you know. But at the same time, it was groundbreaking in terms when you mentioned, oh, you know, the idea of feeling of being futuristic, you know, in their music, which was really ahead of its time, because it was, you know, it was breaking traditions in terms of music making and creativity by exploring various instruments and what would have been considered as, you know, unusual instruments. I mean, machines, technology, you know, which is really part of everyday music now. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And with the example of Kraftwerk, you know, knowing their music, they were kind of building this utopian kind of machine-driven future. But there are other examples in that chapter where you talk about the convergence of experimentalism and technology and how those came together to impact the development of other genres. And you mentioned psychedelic, you mentioned dub, you mentioned hip hop and ambient. Talk with us about those genres as well, and perhaps some examples on how technology and experimentalism fueled a kind of vision of what those genres were supposed to represent.
Yes, for sure. What I should mention with experimental music through personal experience, you know, it's just like, it can be a complex term in itself, like virtual, like popular music and so on. And when I was a music student, professors had their own take on experimental music and they never talked about these styles. And, you know, as a creator or composer, you know, every music you hear is based on some kind of experiment of some sort. And I felt it was important to talk about these groups and producers and these styles. So, for example, with dub, you know, rightfully so, you know, it was around about the same time, it started around the same time when psychedelic rock was evolving, and that idea of experimenting with sound effects and technologies in the recording studio. And with dub music alone, it was always about the drum and bass sound. Most of it was instrumental as well, but the emotions were more important. It was politically driven, and you could feel that through the music, especially with the bass and the way they manipulate, for example, King Tubby, the way he would manipulate with the sound effects, you know, that frustration, you know, without having to hire a singer and scream, you know. So it was all about feeling the effects and putting your creative thoughts through experimenting in the recording studio and the use of sound effects. So that's with dub, for example. And the other styles that I mentioned, such as hip hop as well, of course, through samples as well, you know, totally different mood. But for example, you know, using existing sources from other texts or other mediums can bring out new meaning in a new piece of music. So that's, and you get that a lot when you look at hip-hop music. So I'll use Madvillain as an example, how they managed to transform, you know, Brazilian music into a haunting sound, you know, nice holiday feel, laid back sound, but into a totally different context, just through samples alone and through lyrics as well, which I find really, really interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, and what I deliberately did at the end of the chapter, I used a group, British group, and producer Bomb the Bass and Tim Simonon, to demonstrate electronica. But what's interesting about that track, it displays all the different styles that I mentioned in the chapter. So, you know, a bit of ambient, bit of dub, and, you know, electronic and so on. And it's quite progressive as well, you know. It does progress. It does, you know, so you get a nice exploration of the different styles that I mentioned in that chapter. So I thought that was a nice round off of it. And, you know, and again, the emphasis is on the bass and the drums as well. So I thought that was interesting to bring that in and just to demonstrate, look, this is a nice example of experimental music, of that futuristic sound and the experimenting with music technology as well, that futuristic sound. Yeah.
So in your book, and even during this interview, you talk about bringing different styles, a lot of differences, and it brings to mind a concept you discuss in your book of something that Brian Eno calls variety. And it's about exploring the foundations and impressions of experimental music and how this leads to unpredictable but discoverable new kinds of composition. Can you walk us through what Eno means by this concept of variety and how it contributes to the creation of experimental music?
Yeah, so it's, you know, anything goes, basically. Anything goes, surreal, picking up everyday sound, sonic, noise, random even, that's totally experimental as well, making random decisions, choices, applying mood. That idea is very postmodern, that idea of breaking rules and convention, anything goes, having that idea of variety of sounds in the music. And one, and in that book, I, you know, the track that I used, you know, it was like a happy accident for Brian Eno that he created that composition, because he wasn't unwell at the time, and he wanted to listen to a piece of music, but he was, when he tried to listen to the piece of music, he was absorbing everything, the atmosphere, the sounds, the birds singing, and, you know, and thought, okay, this is really interesting, you know, you could do something with this from a compositional stance, right? So yeah, and this obviously brought out a new way of composing music, you know, just rather than having tuneful melodies, just again that word experimenting with everyday sounds and technology and putting things and sounds into reality, really. So, yeah.
In your book, you say, in the digital virtual era, we are constantly reminded of the past due to recycled sounds that are presented in the music, and that music is constantly being experimented with sounds that are manipulated via technology and everyday sonics. And in this chapter, you discuss, as an example to illustrate this concept, is the Grey Album. What is the Grey Album, and how was it developed, and what was its impact on music industry and culture in regards to virtual and digital music?
So the Grey Album is a very complex case study, but very exciting as well, which did cause a divide in the music industry and disruption in the music industry. So the Grey Album came about in the mashup era around 2004, where mashup culture was really becoming hot, and the term remixology in music was really becoming trendy thanks to internet and peer-to-peer and downloading, illegal downloading music as well. It was that era, you know, when everyone was downloading MP3s illegally and so on. So with the Grey Album, which was, you know, remixed by Danger Mouse, Brian Burton, in 2003, the hip-hop artist JC released what was known as his final album, which it wasn't, the Black Album. And as a, you know, as a present to his fans, he released an a cappella version, and basically said, do what you want with it, okay? You know, because it was a mashup, you know, so he invited them to do a mashup. And Danger Mouse remixed it with the Beatles, what was known as the White Album, self-titled album, Beatles, but it was famously known as the White Album. And bearing in mind the time frame, 2004, I guess if you hear it now, you know, you wouldn't think much of it. But back then, when technology was starting to evolve very fast, this was quite unique, because who would have thought remixing the Beatles and JC, you know, totally different styles, totally different eras. And of course, it was going to upset hardcore fans, mainly from the Beatles side. So around that time, it was quite unique and brave of Danger Mouse to do that. And he did argue it was an experiment only. But you know, naturally, when people did get their hands on it, you know, it somehow landed in the ether in cyberspace, and people started downloading it and were actually praising it and said, wow, picture this, Beatles and JC performing together, making music together, you know, who would have thought it? All thanks to digital technology, Danger Mouse made it possible by using his laptop, you know, very simple setup, very simple software, Sonic Acid software he used. But, you know, and this made it possible to remix and to bring, a futuristic sound, you know, that my obsession and of bringing the past into the present, you know, who would have thought it, you know, mixing the past and present, that sounds futuristic. But yeah, there was a bit of a downside to that, because even though Danger Mouse did argue it was an experiment, he wasn't intending to sell it or whatnot. He couldn't anyway if he wanted to. He didn't, you know, he didn't have permission to use the sound recordings of the Beatles album, which of course that kind of upset the label, EMI. So Danger Mouse and the fans were actually confronted with a cease and desist letter, and Danger Mouse obeyed, but the fans and admirers of the great album wanted to show, look, this is amazing, people need to hear this. So they held a one-day cyber protest about it, and that got even more global attention, because when I first found out about it, I found it out in one of the national TV news over here in England, because they were saying there's going to be this protest, you know, everyone's going to download, you know, and poor Danger Mouse had nothing to do with it. But, you know, the fans got threatened, because to participate in the protest, you download it, upload it on your blog and encourage more people to download it and just spread the word and spread, you know, this is great. This is what you can do with creativity, right? So, you know, there were so many downloads. It did very, very well. And as I said in the book, you know, there was a bit of a flaw in one of the copyright laws, which meant EMI could not sue in the States anyway. That was only in the States, but no one complained over here. But obviously the publishers, some of the publishers that are not affiliated directly with the Beatles, they did try to sue the fans in other means and forms, but they didn't, because it would have been such a complex case. And even if Danger Mouse did want to obtain permission, you know, there's so many channels to go through, it would have been a headache for him. You know, it just wouldn't be worth it. The only way he could avoid the situation, and if he did wanted to release it officially, he would have to play cover versions or something, you know. So yeah, but the aftermath of that was, here we are in 2022, you know, we are still talking about it, and it's such a fascinating album, because it is, from a creative point of view, it is very, very great to listen to. But from a legal side of things, you know, it is good if you want to learn more about music copyright, okay, what could have been, you know, if he did get sued, you know, because it is such a complex case if this did go to court, because there's so many people involved. And this could have ruined Danger Mouse's career. It could have, because he was only an amateur producer at the time, you know, but he is a well much demanded music producer today. So, you know, it really helped him. And, you know, but in a way, it did, that particular album did disrupt the industry because, yeah, he used music without permission, okay. Yeah, it got uploaded on peer-to-peer on the internet, you know, because we were in that time, you know, the likes of Napster and all that, you know, it's when you mentioned earlier accessibility, you know, people having access to music, you know, which should be seen as a positive thing. I know there's two sides, you know, because it encouraged the listeners to listen to all kinds of music, but yeah, of course, it's publishers, the songwriters, artists who are going to lose out, and obviously we are aware, for those who will kick up a fuss such as EMI, we will know about it. But yeah, it did mark a turning point in terms of music production and having access to music. But at the same time, it also gave upcoming producers and creators the opportunity and say, look, oh, if they can do this, I can do this as well, because I've got the laptop, I can afford the software, and so on. So, you know, it has opened a big can of worms, so to speak. Yeah.
So I remember this era with Napster and when peer-to-peer downloading was making, you know, its scene. I had LimeWire, and I know you saw news all the time about the recording industries suing teenagers and other people for huge, vast amounts of money, right? And this is nothing new. Whenever there's new technology, the industry is always concerned about how does it get its share. I mean, several decades before, when VHS tapes came into existence, you know, the industries thought that was going to kill cinema because people could just constantly tape off their TV. So I'm never really concerned about how the industry is always going to react to things. So my question for you is, with the rise of peer-to-peer sharing and examples like the Grey album, how did that influence creativity? How did that influence people who are making music at home without, you know, access to industry connections or recording studios? What was the impact of the album on that?
Yeah, so it was very, very positive. In terms of creativity, it did inspire upcoming, you know, or other producers, or even students to mash up or remix existing music or sources out there, and to instantly share with their friends or upload on YouTube or what have you. So it was the idea of distributing and consuming music freely without having to have a middle person or gatekeeper or begging on the industry door, you know, please listen to my music. So it kind of opened opportunity and showed that, you know, anyone can do this, anyone can have a go. It's just happened that, you know, bearing in mind the time frame, Danger Mouse used the Daring group at the time, you know, but at the same time, he did argue that the Beatles are one of his favourite groups. And, you know, even Sir Paul McCartney said he loves the album. So, you know, but yeah, so in terms of that, yes, it opened more opportunity for people to experiment with music and to make music. And in some cases, perhaps about officially learning how to play an instrument, you know, especially because obviously, I argue that the laptop, the computer, it should be considered as a musical instrument, you know, depending on the software, you know, because of the software you have. So, yeah, so it's definitely a time where, you know, devices, instruments are definitely evolving and becoming more digital, and opportunities for people to experiment and explore and use the instrument as their own, what Danger Mouse did. So I think definitely it did inspire especially the young to explore, and especially now, you know, people are remixing their favorite tracks for fun. Okay, so definitely it gives them the opportunity.
You say in your book, we may think that in the current digital age, creators in the music industry, in particular performers, are gaining greater control over their artistry, but that manufacturing artists into disposable material is still the norm within the industry. When I read that, I think of some classic examples like the Monkees, the Archies, or even Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, the Sex Pistols. Though they are older bands, the much more established bands, how has technology changed in recent years in order for the music industry to still create manufactured artists?
Oh, that's a good question. Different approaches to that. So for example, some of the bands you mentioned, you know, all behind the scenes, you know, very manufactured, but also dabbling with technology, especially with likes of the Alvin and Chipmunks. The industry are obviously thinking ahead with their feet, you know, because there's so much going on out there. People, independent, you know, upcoming musicians are DIY, they're doing it themselves and having gained control of the artistry and music and just uploading and sharing, especially on TikTok, and gaining, you know, exposure through there. So obviously the music industry are really, again, experimenting and finding different ways or even different new ways of marketing groups, you know, unique ways, or just trying, you know, and observing or keeping an eye on what's going on out there and trying to hone in on that. Because, you know, we've heard that maybe not so much recently, but we are hearing that, you know, the argument is the industry in decline, you know, because of peer-to-peer or because even of legal downloading and piracy, of course, the pandemic as well, you know. But I believe it's still a very much thriving commercial industry. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. You know, they do make these threats. For example, the mashup culture, when that was very hot in the 2004, EMI were the first album after that incident. They were the first label to bring out a mashup album. So, okay, can't beat them, join them kind of thing. In terms of manufactured artists, we are being more exposed to it if we are observing from an consumer. You know, we are seeing them manufactured in front of our eyes and dropped in front of our eyes as well. And for those who are successful, they're really utilising the social media, that idea, you know, having that direct giving that illusion of a direct connection with the fans and consumers. So that is pretty much more evident now. The fans and consumers kind of appear to have a relationship, if you like, what's a virtual relationship with that famous artist or whatnot. But really, is it really? Or is it being controlled by the label, you know? So especially when you read social media posts by famous artists, you get that impression, oh, it's maybe Taylor Swift. Or, oh, she wrote this today on Instagram, but really, who is it, really her kind of thing? So, yeah, so, you know, the industries definitely still have a sense of control in that sense.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
alongside talking about manufactured artists, you also explore concepts in your book like identity and authenticity. And this is something that's always interesting to me because there's a lot of purists out there when it comes to music who say like, well, it's got to be real people in a room playing real music, or they might say how they present themselves on stage or on an album cover is inauthentic. That to me is just so lacking in imagination. And you talk about some great examples in your book, such as David Bowie, who is a personal hero of mine. And also there's Madonna. And you mentioned Grace Jones, who very famously on her nightclubbing album says, "Feeling like a woman, looking like a man." So there's examples where people are being authentic to themselves as how they present themselves and maintaining a certain identity. But I want to know how you define these concepts of identity and authenticity in your book, and how do they relate?
Yeah, so identity and authenticity are always interesting terms to use when we are looking at popular music artists and musicians. And yes, there is definitely an interplay with those terms as well. And what's interesting, identity, we do think of the persona of the artist, maybe on stage or even in the recording studio as well. Okay, so you know, how are they presenting themselves vocally or in the music, okay, or through their lyrics? And then of course physically, it'll be in the music video or some kind of performance. And and with the likes of David Bowie and Madonna, there are two perfect examples because, you know, up to this day, regardless of age or time frame, we are aware of these magnificent artists, and they have successfully explored their artistry, their identities as well, for every album, for every performance. And yes, I did not really focus much on them, but I could not avoid talking about them because they did lay the foundations of that chapter, and they have been documented so many times, right? So, but what was really fascinating about these two artists, they are very, very postmodern. And yeah, you can argue, are they really authentic? Because when we see different personas, they're obviously basing it on other texts or other sources, but it's the way they project that, okay? It's the way they portray that in their performance, and they do it very well and experiment with their identity as well, which makes it very much authentic. And for that chapter, I did look up Grace Jones because I'm very passionate of her work and her as well. And what was really interesting, you know, as you mentioned, you know, she explores her gender, sexuality, her identity, even though she might have a particular identity that we may all be aware of, you know, the suits, the short hair and whatnot. It's the way how she displays that on stage, in her photo shoots, her acting even, you know, her behaviour. It's the way she pulls that off all the time. And, you know, what we are seeing, we are just witnessing her persona, her identity. We're not really bothered what she's like in real life because she's very mysterious and, you know, very iconic, you know. So, you know, and timeless, ageless, if you like, because, you know, here we are. There is this fascination about her. Yeah. And in that book, I talk about a video that's perhaps really unexpected because, you know, I could have chosen any song, any of the famous songs, but this song that I chose, Love You to Life, I argue, you know, this is where she actually lets her guard down. You know, you might see the emotional side of her, but do we? Okay, you know, and she's still teasing us, but we do see the emotional side of her. And if you haven't heard of Grace Jones, start with this video because really, you also see different, even though she's naked, you do see different sides of Grace Jones. You know, she does her Grace Jones look. You see the emotional side of her. You see her as a ghost even, okay, or a robot even. It's how she controls it with her body. Not only that, in this case, when I said she lets down her guard, because usually she's in control of her performances, In this case, she's controlled by digital lighting effects and different colours, and I think that is really, really fascinating. So, yeah, so you do see her in a different light in a virtual sense. And with The Weeknd, I think he's definitely one to watch, because he also displays his love for David Bowie, and he's still very young, and every album, every performance, he's experimenting with his identity and his music as well, in terms of style and genre. And he's doing okay. You know, he's doing really well with that. So I think it'd be really, really interesting to see how he evolves over the next few decades or so.
You discuss how technology can help a musician, regardless of experience, achieve success without being tied up to the major music industry, and it's largely due to the role that the internet plays in the distribution and consumption of music. How does musical identity play a role in an artist achieving success for themselves?
Yeah, so again, it's all, they can have a choice how they want to do it. Okay, they might not want to show themselves. They might want to be avatars, or they might be animated. Or maybe. Do a mashup video of some sort and just make sure their music is heard somehow. So in a way, you know, people who do want to be recognised for their music but feel that pressure, you know, do I really have to reveal myself, you know, reveal my true identity? No, they don't have to. This is where virtuality can come into play. They could be whoever they want to be, right? So they can disguise themselves in some form, or, you know, or collaborate with someone, okay? Or just tease the audience, you know, go in disguise or tease the audience. It's not a new thing really, because you hear, you know, like with electronic or dance music, we're not really aware of the DJ until you see them live, really. So, or even unless they're a big superstar DJ, you don't really see them in music videos, really. So, you know, so it's that idea of, you know, making sure, if you might want to mention Daft Punk as well, you know, it's all about the music, you know, and make sure the music is being heard. But obviously now with the likes of TikTok and so, you know, and the way Instagram has evolved, It has got to the stage where, especially for the young, and that word choices, it has come to the stage where it might be challenging to stay hooked onto one particular song because the instant is scrolling and whatnot. Okay, so yeah, so definitely the way people are consuming music has definitely changed. So I think that might add a bit more pressure to upcoming artists, because whatever they produce, it has to really reach out, you know, if they really want to be acknowledged and be recognised for their music. It's really got to grab the attention of the consumers, the listeners, audience out there.
It's interesting you mentioned music videos, and we're discussing how the internet changes how people consume music. And for like the last 40 years, you know, traditional visual mediums for music have largely been animation, film, and music video. And I think about artists who started with those mediums and later adopted more digital presence, groups like Gorillaz, who started with animated music videos in the early 2000s, but are now fully embracing virtual worlds and performances. So I wanted to get an understanding of how these traditional mediums evolved with the onset of digital and virtual performances, and how we get things like VR and immersive digital concert experiences.
Yeah, so definitely, you know, that has really took off in this century, right? So, and thanks to technology, it is still evolving. So like you mentioned with Gorillaz, it's just a purely animation group, okay, without going into the story, the concept of it yet, but as time evolves, as you mentioned, we witness in the videos VR, okay, even AR, human form with virtual form, you know, lots of collaboration, and I think as well, you know, and it comes down to choice, and thanks to the pandemic, we do have more options and how we want to watch a concert. Okay, is it going to be live streamed on YouTube for free, you know? Do we want to go to a physical concert anymore, Or what about for those who don't want to, who are not old enough to go to a concert? You know, this is where Fortnite comes into it. You know, I think that's been a bit of a game changer with video games as well, in terms of live performances, because it has reached out to other areas, other mediums, in terms of where we experience live performances. And, you know, so we have definitely have more choices now on how we want to consume live music. And of course, you know, even though it's been experimented with already, in terms of holograms or, you know, performing live with dead artists, for example, even though that has been done in the past, that's nothing new, but we are perhaps going to reach that stage where technology will make it right and it will make it even more popular. And yeah, which may bring out, you know, which will obviously, it will bring out questions and debate and perhaps a divide, but of course it's going to be an audience out there, it's going to love it, right? But I think really live performances, definitely more choices and more options now on how we want to view live performances.
So when we talk about creating virtual concert experiences and utilizing the internet, the whole purpose is to get music out there to more listeners, to connect with more people, because that's what an artist ultimately wants, is for people to listen to their music. And this brings, you know, this brings into discussion a lot of interesting topics, such as accessibility. You know, there's a lot of people who, either due to the pandemic or another kind of disability, are unable to enjoy concerts in the same way. There's also the ability for people just through internet access to hear sounds from places far away that otherwise they would never have access to. So I want to get a sense of how virtual and digital spaces allow for these new audiences to come on board, and what is the effect of that?
So in the book, I do address that, the different ways of consuming or better term, experiencing music. And of course, especially now, because obviously I wrote this book before the pandemic, but as we know, there's so many choices now in terms of experiencing and watching performances. And what's interesting, you know, is, yeah, there are, of course, for whatever reason, you know, if people are attending virtually, they may not have that social experience, but they get to hear their favorite artist's music, gain a sense of how they, you know, gain a virtual experience of attending a live concert in their own personal space. So yeah, so which is great, because obviously, you know, for whatever reason, like you mentioned, maybe it could be a disability, or they could be feeling anxious, you know, but they still want to experience live music. This, you know, they have that choice. And I feel that it's really important now, especially with the internet and virtual performances. It's very important that makes this really possible. And yeah, the social effect might not be evident, but you know, it depends. You might have a few friends around, but it does give you that unique experience and a new opportunity in experiencing music as well. And I do give various examples, various ways in that book. You know, there are various ways now, whether it's a live stream on YouTube, you know, maybe you couldn't afford to go to the concert, okay, but thankfully, some, you know, there's a live stream of it, so you don't miss out. Or you might stay in touch with your friend who's at a concert, and they, you know, sending you WhatsApp or quick footages. You know, it kind of gives you that other kind of virtual experience of being there without actually being there. Or this, or you could attend post concerts, like with apps such as Melody VR, where you do pay to have access to past performances, but you might have that novelty effect as well. The more, you know, depending how much you pay. So, for example, you might want to jump on stage with Elton John or go on the plane with Paul McCartney. So there are incentives now, even though, of course, it's not real, but it does give you that nice entertainment, that experience of another way of experiencing your favorite artist's music, and a personal intimate experience as well.
So we talked about ways in which digital and virtual music has opened up a lot of barriers, and it's primarily due to the internet, and the internet does connect people with all kinds of ideas and other resources. But I want to understand the flip side of that and, you know, other issues in terms of accessibility, such as government restrictions to the internet technology.
Yeah.
So what are some of the current ongoing challenges that are facing the digital and virtual spaces of music?
Yeah. So obviously, you know, of course, it's not obviously free for all globally. Yeah, of course, there are some nations or countries that may have a crackdown on having access to music for whatever reason. Okay. And of course, that limits the consumer, the user's experience of music, which is really, really difficult. And other, and of course, in having decent access to internet as well. That idea of that being controlled again. So yeah, so it's not really free for all, and you know, it does bring challenges in that, and that may encourage other ways in accessing music, which just may not be considered as, you know, legal, okay? And again, that might result in more consequences as well. So yeah, there's all that to think about as well. And yeah, it is, you know, it is misfortunate that is happening as well, especially for upcoming creators who may feel restricted. You know, I better not talk about certain subjects or whatnot in case I'll be censored, of, you know, and so on. So yeah, I mean, there is all that to consider as well. And not only that, yeah, even though we all like to think music is a very positive experience anyway, whether it's socially or even culturally or even in a religious sense, you know, yes, we do have that negative side of things as well, or backlash, if you like, negative responses, which can, especially now the internet, you know, people are quick to share their views or, you know, their dislikes, if you like, towards certain artists or certain music. So, yeah, we are in that era where, you know, we do have to be considerate and think of the fuller picture in terms of, you know, how do we perceive music and what does this mean for the musician, creator, listener and audience and consumer as well.
When we talk about ways in which there might be a restrictive element for people to make or consume music, money and industry tend to be the biggest factors. And you discuss in your book how a lot of music creators have little to no control of their artistry and identity in the music industry, yet internet technology has fostered a continually expanding DIY culture. How has this DIY culture grown, and how has the music industry adapted to handle the monetary elements of that?
So we are in that era now, going back to the term accessibility and affordability. Yeah, people do have the opportunity to create music and have control, to begin with, if you like, of their music, in the hope to be discovered, acknowledged and recognised, and for their music to be shared. The industry are monitoring this, you know, because that is the idea of missing out on the next big thing, the idea of not signing up that artist, you know, it's that competition, right? So it has made it very, very competitive. I mean, you know, I use Lil Nas X, for example, you know, a perfect example as a DIY, very young, but he knew what he was doing, you know, very clever DIY, independent, very clever marketing tactic he used there with the help of Twitter, and he just left it to the fans to get on with it, and then before you know it, he was snapped up by a major label. So definitely we are in that. There's many ways of approaching this because, yeah, the fans, the audience are very much interactive. They're very much involved now. They are doing the free promotion for the artists, if you like, which is great. And, of course, with the industry, once they're caught on with that, they tend to get the fans involved even more in terms of marketing, you know, maybe with some perks, but with the terms of utilizing social media. So social media has really you know, it helped with the marketing sense of it. So, and I think the music industry have really honed in on the audience as well. Yeah, especially in terms of using this social media. So, but in all honesty, you know, I don't think the music industry have that much to worry about, because, you know, they're still having success. They're still finding ways of marketing or discovering artists. And, you know, of course, it's the performances as well. You know, live performances have made a major comeback. Festivals are coming back, you know. So all the money is with that, really. So, you know, and as we know, it's not cheap to go to a live performance these days. And, of course, merchandise even, you know. So there's billions of ways of, you know, that the industry are still having their hands on artists or discovering artists as well. But what has made a big difference is really getting the audience involved somehow, especially in terms of including social media practices as well.
It's interesting you bring up social media, because you explore social media very in depth in terms of allowing opportunities for artists to connect with fans and fans to connect with artists. And you proceed going into the topic of social media by discussing some other examples in history where artists have embraced computer and internet technology, whether it's Bowie in the 90s with his Jump CD-ROM, or apps created by Bjork, Massive Attack, Radiohead. But you discuss a lot about the concept of going viral, virality, in relation to social media. And this is where information is shared simultaneously over a short period of time across social networks. And some examples of this have been Drake's Hotline Bling, Harlem Shake, and even the death of David Bowie as a kind of act of grievance and mourning on social media. You brought up Lil Nas X, who you say is probably the most prominent example of music going viral. Tell us a little bit about his story, what happened, and how that came to be.
Yeah, so the way he utilized social media, he's still very young, and, you know, of course, he's in that generation, the social media generation. Yeah, so when he created Old Town Road, the way he promoted it was just a simple tweet on Twitter. He used a meme and of a cowboy, you know, a cowboy of a meme, like a funny meme, and the tweet was simple. It just said country music is evolving, and you hear a bit of his song in the background, and that, just that alone, what's that about? Okay, it went viral. Okay, and then when you hear the music, you think, oh my goodness, country music, a bit of trap, a bit of hip-hop, what's going on? Okay, of course, you know, that was unique. Okay, but daring as well, because it's country music. And and of course, once that caught on, that tweet, it got in the hands of TikTokers, and this, you know, they came up with the Yeehaw challenge, which obviously went viral in its own, but they used Lil Nas X as the soundtrack, and it became people more intrigued about the music. And once and obviously later on, we found out, oh, it's Lil Nas X now, you know, Old Town Road. And as we know it, when he got snapped up by the label, that's when he collaborated with Billy Ray Cyrus, and that's when it went number one forever in the chart. So yeah, so that is great way of getting into the industry, but a unique way of being discovered as well, just by a single tweet and a meme that just went viral. So yeah, very, very clever. I think he's very clever in terms of marketing himself, you know. So yeah, and exciting as well.
Yeah, he's very clever in terms of just kind of driving where music is going to be aesthetically and how we consume it. So I wanted to talk with you about some recent signals as to where music is going and what music in the future is going to be like. And in recent years, we've seen examples of where the music industry is going in terms of things like hologram performances, those hologram performances by Tupac and Whitney Houston. or even artificial intelligence creating new music. There is a there was like some art project last year where a team had created a 4-track EP of artists who had died due to drug and alcohol addiction and created new music just through artificial intelligence. And they created new songs mimicking Amy Winehouse, Nirvana, The Doors, and Jimi Hendrix. And I want to get a sense from you as an expert in digital and virtual music. Where do you see the future of music going with this?
Yeah. Where I see it, I like to say there's going to be even more opportunity and accessibility to music. But yeah, but when you mention AI, I have to admit that does frighten me a bit as a musician and an expert, or even as an educator, even, you know, the idea, you know, I've had this conversation with students, will we have a job in the future kind of thing, you know, and it just goes to show with the examples that you just mentioned, there are various ways in applying AI, right? So, you know, the idea of just creating music or you're not creating music, so to speak, you know, and just taking control again, you know. The industry might love that, okay, because it's going to, obviously, they're going to say, okay, we don't need any more session musicians or songwriters anymore, you know, and they will find a way. Unfortunately, well, I don't say unfortunately, they might find a way of making it very, very successful, and it may catch on. But for me personally, it does concern me a bit. It's interesting, it's exciting, and I like to see how it will evolve. But at the same time, I still, there's still a place for upcoming creators and musicians, right? And to experiment with music and to bring out new genres and styles, you know, I think it just goes to show music is very much evolving. In terms of hologram performances, yeah, as we know, you know, it has been tried and tested. It has failed a lot of times, but it just has been one-off performances. But I think the way technology is evolving, hologram performances, yeah, that could be another way of experiencing live music. The idea, I did not go into it completely in the book, but the idea of resurrecting dead artists, yeah, for me personally, I'm not too sure how I feel about that. It does sound a bit weird, but at the same time, I do appreciate the technology. I mean, in fact, it does scare me, you know, if I was forced to watch a show, that would freak me out personally, but it could be educational as well, you know, and it brings a different experience of listening and watching a live performance, so that you should be, yeah, it should be acknowledged, and it's another way of experimenting with music.
Shara, this has been a great conversation. I had a lot of fun. Thank you for joining me today. Your book was excellent. Really fantastic.
Well, thank you so much, Bradley. I'm really pleased to hear that. And thank you so much for the opportunity.
My name is Bradley Morgan, and you've been listening to New Books in Music with my guest today, Shara Rambaran. Her book is Virtual Music, Sound, Music, and Image in the Digital Era, and is published by Bloomsbury Academic.